media system we get as a result, what we're getting more and more of, more concentrated, has distinctly negative implications for democracy. I mean, even if I said nothing more, just the fact that so few people control communication, even if they were the CEOs of those nine companies, the most wonderful people on earth, we've got the leading Gandhi expert in the world here, even if they make Gandhi look like a slime ball, these are the nine greatest humans who ever lived, ran those companies, it would be irrelevant. Having that much power in so few people, doesn't matter how good they are, what sort of people they are, is just wrong in a democracy. Organized and accountable democratic public broadcasting service is something we have to deal with. It's a tough problem. But the one thing we know for sure, it can't be settled unless it's out in the open and we debate it. It's not going to be settled behind closed doors. And we can come up with a better system than the one we have. That much we know, too. Other countries have done a much better job.
Welcome to KPFK Matters, a special program mandated by the Interim Pacifica National Board on Pacifica's future, structure, and bylaws. My name is Rafael Renteria. For the next 2 hours, we'll be talking about the future of Pacifica Radio and your role in it. The first hour will provide history, background, and discussions about the process of democratization currently underway at the Pacifica Network. The second hour will be devoted entirely to unscreened listener call-ins. You'll have the chance to communicate directly with other listeners about what is most important to you in the making of a new Pacifica. Please stay tuned and join the conversation. In the signal areas of all five Pacifica stations, KPFK in Berkeley, WBAI in New York, KPFK in Southern California, KPFT in Houston, and WPFW in Washington, D.C., there have recently been a series of open meetings of bylaws committees made up of listener activists, national board members, local board members, station staff, and volunteers. The job of these committees is to make proposals as to what these bylaws should look like. Now, we are bringing to the airwaves this important discussion of how Pacifica will be remade. Joining us for today's discussion are Lynn Gary from New York, Jeff Blankford and Carol Spooner from the San Francisco Bay Area, David Adelson and Fernando Velasquez from Los Angeles. But first, we'd like to share with you some historical perspective about Pacifica's original structure from Matthew Lazar. Lazar is the author of Pacifica Radio, Rise of an Alternative Network, and is widely recognized as a leading authority on the early history of the Pacifica Network. In the following segment, Lazar describes the feelings of Pacifica founder Lewis Hill and his compatriots, who were pacifists and conscientious objectors, or COs, during World War II, and their outlook with respect to who would hold power at Pacifica.
When Lewis Hill got out of his CO camp, for a while he was the director of the National Committee on Conscientious Objectors for the American Civil Liberties Union. And then he left and went back to the San Francisco Bay Area, where he had been a student at Stanford before the war, and he began organizing the Pacifica Foundation. And when he did that, he started organizing, when he created this nonprofit in 1946, which he did, and when he began organizing to build a radio station somewhere in the San Francisco Bay Area. First he wanted it to be in Richmond, California, then he wanted it to be in Berkeley. He wound up settling for Berkeley, although that wasn't his first choice. He knew some things. He knew who his staff would be. They would mostly be pacifists and former COs who he had met or worked with, or in some cases helped. He knew who his big financial backers would be. They would be liberals and Quaker pacifists who had lots of money and who were willing to help him out. And there was one group of people who he didn't know who they would be, and that was his listeners. And as a result of that, he didn't deal them into the governance structure of the Pacifica Radio Network. He and his pacifist friends were, in fact, distrustful of popular democracy. They had the experience of being overwhelmingly marginalized by the Second World War. Most people in the United States supported the war against Hitler. My family supported the war against Hitler. I'm sure that if I had been alive at that time and of draft age, I would have done what my father did, which was gone into the Army. Hill understood that his ideas would be, in time of war, extremely unpopular. And as a result, he was very distrustful of the idea of giving formal power within the governance of the organization to the people to whom he would broadcast. That if KPFA had gone on the air in 1939 rather than 1949, there's no question in my mind that by 1942, 1943, if KPFA was on the air preaching against the United States involvement in the Second World War and the listeners had been given the vote, they would have voted Hill out of office. Actually, that's probably, it probably wouldn't have even come to that because people probably would have dragged Hill out of the studio and beaten him up in the street for the things he thought about the Second World War. Today, we who have been critical of the United States bombing of Afghanistan find ourselves closer, I think, to the situation that Lewis Hill faced than at any other time in the history of the Pacifica Radio Network. During the Vietnam War, during various phases of the Cold War in the 1950s, the Pacifica Radio Network's critical stance towards the various wars of intervention which took place, which were executed by the United States, pretty much had the support of much of the left. If large portions of the American people didn't approve of them, large portions of the left did. But the left is in very great disarray over the bombing of Afghanistan and the and whatever it is that the Bush administration is going to do about terrorism. So that we really do find ourselves, we who have been critical of this war, in the same place that Lewis Hill found himself. Although I think it should be noted that the vast majority of people who are involved with Pacifica today are not pacifists. I think most Pacificans today are sympathetic on one level or another to pacifism and certainly recognize the important role that pacifists have played in the movements for peace and social justice. And while there are still pacifists within the Pacifica Radio organization, no question in my mind, most people aren't. I think that if you surveyed most people, they would not tell you that they are pacifists. While they may question war, could we really say that many Pacificans during the late 1970s and early 1980s who supported the Nicaraguan Revolution were pacifists, or who supported the Cuban Revolution were pacifists, or who supported the Guatemalan or Salvadoran insurgents were pacifists? I think that while there's a core of people within Pacifica who remain who continue to affiliate with the pacifist ideology, it's not like it was in the late 1940s and early 1950s when most of the people who were associated with Pacifica governance were pacifists. Today, the organization is much, much larger and much more broadly dispersed among the progressive left, and it's a much bigger and much more complicated organization, both organizationally and ideologically, than it was then. And that's the reason why, in my opinion, the non-formal participation of the listener subscribers is an anachronistic practice at this point. Today, because the Pacifica Radio Network is so much more complicated and so much bigger than it was in Lewis Hill's day, we need a leadership which is seen as legitimate by a goodly portion of the organization. And the organization at this time doesn't have any system that produces that legitimate leadership. You have a lot of people, they're perfectly willing to tell you that they feel that they're legitimate. You know, you had Mary Frances Berry. Hi, I'm Mary Frances Berry. I'm with the U.S. Civil Rights Commission. I deserve to run Pacifica Radio. You have all these people who are willing, on the basis of their credentials, to represent themselves as the guiding force of Pacifica Radio. But when you say to them, well, who put you in charge of this? They don't have a good answer. What we need is we need to have a system of governance that resembles the values which we constantly hear on Pacifica Radio around governance everywhere else. And what you always hear on Pacifica Radio is that the world should be run more democratically.
Our historian of Pacifica Radio talking about Pacifica's governance in a recent interview with Heidi Chesney for Pacifica Matters, a listener-created program on the future of the Pacifica Network. In the years since its founding, Pacifica has grown into one of the largest non-commercial broadcasters in the U.S. Its signals can reach more than one in five American homes, and its broadcast licenses are valued at well over $300 million. Its annual budget is on the order of $12 million. Questions about who and what Pacifica will serve and how it will provide that service have been at the heart of the struggle over the direction of Pacifica in recent years. To understand the nature of this struggle, one needs to understand the changes that have taken place throughout community broadcasting in the U.S. Media historian and community radio activist Robert McChesney, professor of communications at the University of Illinois, addressed this topic in a speech he gave a year and a half ago.
The real culprit, in my view, is not technology, but what we call neoliberalism, a term I like to use a lot. It's a sort of an academic-y term, I know, but I think it really captures the essence of what's going on globally in the United States better than any other term. Back in the 30s, and even into the 60s, when I was coming of age, there used to be a term about fascism. Some of you might remember this term. They say, what's the difference between fascism and capitalism? And they say, fascism is capitalism with the gloves off, meaning fascism is capitalism without democratic rights, without elections, freedoms. It's just pure, unadulterated capitalist power. Well, that's actually not true. We now know, and I think any careful look shows, that fascism is a far more complicated phenomenon than that. It's mass movements, all sorts of bigotry, racism. There's a whole lot of other stuff going on in fascism than just capitalism and naked class power. But neoliberalism is capitalism with the gloves off. That is exactly what neoliberalism is. It's a capitalism premised in the idea that the rich should rule the world. Whoever makes the most money win. Deregulate business, lower taxes, lessen the power, if not explicitly smash labor, turn everything that can possibly be made profitable over to the market to be subject to market principles, with a damn the torpedoes attitude towards the social consequences. Now, under neoliberalism in the United States and around the world, public service broadcasting survives, but not on principle, because there's no principled explanation for it now. It only survives due to political strength, because you can muscle up a lobby that listens to it that will fight for it. That's the case in the United States, that's the case in Germany, in Britain, and Scandinavia. On principle, it doesn't fit in at all. In fact, one of the great conflicts in Europe today is the European Union dealing with the fact that public service broadcasting violates all the free market principles they're trying to install as they put in a continental-wide market for their corporations. As the media companies are constantly complaining to the European Union, we have to compete with these guys who are being subsidized. Stop it. And they're saying, you're right. It's a real conflict there, and it's been a real tension there because it's a square peg in a round neoliberal hole.
And indeed, the Gingrich Congress made serious attempts to defund public broadcasting and subject it to a market standard.
I am amazed what I just heard from this other side of the aisle. They said, we have to have government-subsidized broadcasting at taxpayers' expense to counter what you're hearing from the free enterprise system. That you have to have government to get out a public propaganda message instead of listening to what's on news programs or public information programs from free enterprise. That is a socialist approach. I reject it.
CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the public taxpayer-financed component of public broadcasting, will be gone by 98. All my amendment does is phase that cut in a way where they can make the adjustment easier than is otherwise prescribed under the legislation before us. It's a 33% cut, and still, instead of waiting until 97 and taking a 70% hit on their whole budget. It's history, guys. Open your eyes up. You know, we're talking about letting the private sector run it as it always should have.
Would the gentleman further yield?
Yes, indeed.
The gentleman is on the Ways and Means Committee, a great leader on that committee. Could the gentleman give us some idea of how much of tax write-off the commercial television stations get each year? How much the taxpayer subsidizes their operations?
Infinitely preferable to do it in the private sector than in the public sector.
But the gentleman did not answer my question.
These attempts at defunding ultimately failed due to the immense support for public broadcasting. But the activities of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, along with the threat of defunding, drove many community broadcasters further down the road toward using commercial means of audience development, such as target market programming to a specific core audience, to maximize fundraising. At community stations across the country, moves were made to professionalize programming, as volunteerism and diverse radio formats were derided as wasteful of valuable resources, and programming for oppressed groups was dramatically cut. Along with this trend was a trend towards centralizing administrative control of community broadcasting and public radio professionals, and marginalizing listeners and volunteers from the decision-making process. Priorities shifted from providing a platform for a broad diversity of voices in the community to garnering larger and more affluent audiences. McChesney described the pressure on non-commercial broadcasters.
What evolves rationally in the United States in public broadcasting in this context, if you can only do the stuff that's not profitable and you're going to depend on viewers and listeners to bankroll you for whatever the percentage, 20 to 60% of your income, you sure aren't going to aim it at poor people. They can't give you any money. You pitch it to the upper middle class. It's a rational thing to do. Anything else would be suicidal if you're running a station. And so you have a station, a system, pitched at those who have disposable income who can give you money during pledge drives. Perfectly rational.
It may be perfectly rational to target the affluent, but Pacifica was created to serve a different logic. Pacifica was created to serve a specific mission. That mission, as reflected in its articles of incorporation, is to explore the causes of conflict in an attempt to create a more just and peaceful world by using dialogue and discourse to help bring an end to racism and war. The key questions, however, about how Pacifica is to serve its mission were kept off the table for discussion, and the arguments about the impacts of structural adjustment in community broadcasting were kept off the air. Most importantly, listener sponsors had no say about the direction of their stations. The common theme of the nationwide movement to restore Pacifica Radio was that the listener should be able to hear the discussions about Pacifica's future, to participate in them, and to be able to have an impact on Pacifica's direction and its programming. Will the rewriting of Pacifica's bylaws give listener sponsors a meaningful role? That's part of what we're here to talk about.